You're listening to the ESO Network, your station for all things geek.
In a world filled with cigars, craft beer, comics, movies, and video games,
only two men are brave enough to search out all things nerdy.
It's the Cigar Nerds Podcast!
And welcome to Cigar Nerds Podcast. I'm your host, Smokin' Joe.
And I'm Brad Jackson.
So what are we smoking this week, Brad?
This week we are smoking the Brick House, the Traveler.
And the Traveler's kind of, well, this cigar is kind of fitting for two reasons. One, Traveler sounds like aliens. We're going to be talking about some aliens this week. And two, which we'll get into later, the manufacturer of this cigar, J.C. Newman, kind of had a thing going with the movie we're going to talk about this week, which is Independence Day.
Yep, and there's actually going to be two movies we talk about since we finally got around to seeing the second one. Holy shit, we did a thing!
Yeah, we figured since it's the 4th of July came after our last episode, it's kind of a good time to talk about all things Independence Day, and what better Independence Day tradition than watching Independence Day. Yeah. How many times can I fit Independence Day into one sentence?
I don't know.
Five.
Yes. But, I gotta say, man, so far, just getting into the cigar and everything, this is sporting a Nicaragua Havana...
Subtito?
Yeah, this wrapper, I have not heard that before.
It's not... The only other Brickfest I've had is the Brick House Maduro. I'm not familiar with that wrapper.
But we've got a Nicaraguan binder, filler, as of right now, I'm going to put this at about a medium strength. The notes here are earthy. I'm not getting a whole lot of spice out of it.
I'm picking up more of a cedar, but then again, this is probably the only cigar we've sampled so far that comes in a tube. And so it was wrapped in a cedar wrapper. So yeah, that's definitely picking up the notes from that being wrapped in cedar for however long this cigar
has been. So yeah, I mean, woody, earthy, and I gotta say this is not a heavily, some cigars you smoke and it's instantly they're hot boxing the room. They're not cigars that you want to smoke indoors, but this has a more light, airy smoke to it. Still a good mouthfeel and everything, but it's, definitely indoor friendly. I feel like after the end of this cigar, we're not going to sit here with our eyes, burning or anything of that nature because the smoke is just absolutely, filled the room.
I know when I first smoked it, it does release like a nice thick cloud of smoke, but it dissipates very quickly. It doesn't really hang in the air that much. And the fact that these come in a tube, too, they're really good for if you're heading out to the golf course or gun range or whatever, and you need something you can just throw in your bag without carrying your entire, travel humidor, then, these are good traveling smokes, hence the name Traveler.
Yeah, I mean, that's, the...
Or in this day and age, if you're going to go out doing Pokemon hunting and walking around for a couple hours, you can stick one of these in your go bag. And
yeah, I mean, the fact that it's in the aluminum tube here, that... It just adds an extra layer of protection. So, if you don't have the advantage of a humidor or if you're just taking a single stick or something like that, I mean, hell, I would be comfortable throwing this in my pocket, my shorts or whatever. So no need to carry around additional accessories. And,
sometimes my 10-count travel humidor is just too big if I'm, only needing a single stick for the day.
Absolutely. So,
and with that, we'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
Mr. President,
our intelligence tells us the object has settled into a stationary orbit. Part of it is broken off into nearly three dozen other pieces. Smaller than the hull, sir. Yet over 15 miles in width themselves.
Where are they heading?
They should be entering our atmosphere within the next 25 minutes.
Let's just get there as quickly as
possible.
What's
the rush, huh? Think we'll get to Washington and won't be there?
It is confirmed. The unexplained phenomenon is headed for Moscow.
That's life in chess. First, they're positioning their pieces, using this one signal to synchronize their efforts.
And then what?
Checkmate.
Oh my God.
I really don't think they flew 90 billion light years to start a fight.
We gotta stop them! They're gonna kill us all!
Oh, God, I hope they bring back Elvis!
There's gonna be a lot of frightened people out there.
Yeah? I'm one of them.
Something you want to add to this briefing, Captain Hiller?
No, sir. Just a little anxious to get up there and whoop E.T.'s ass. That's all.
And we're back. yeah, this week we're talking about the 20th anniversary of the original Independence Day, a.k.a. ID4.
I want to know, man. Why did it take 20 years? I mean, I almost anticipated a sequel within like 5 years of, you know, the original release of Independence Day in 96. Like,
I don't know, I guess it took it that long to rebuild them, rebuild the world.
Yes, like, maybe. But,
yeah, I mean, this movie was the first one, yeah, and like I said, we'll give you spoiler alerts before we start talking about the second one. But the first one, that was probably one of my favorite movies back then. I mean, it came out 96. It was my junior, senior year of high school. Or just the summer before my senior year of high school. And like I said, it was like redefined what summer blockbusters were, I think. I mean, it was like, because
Dude, I mean, it was so action-packed, and, yeah, you know, the cinematics, and yeah, I mean, that's really one of the dynamics, like, you know, as serious as a movie, you know, and the end-of-life event that the world was facing and everything else, like, just the subtle little, you know, cameos, I mean, it was fun, like,
yeah.
you had that feeling of suspense, and like, oh shit, the world's gonna end, but at the same time, you know, let's lighten the mood a little bit.
Yeah,
and,
I mean,
it was a fun
hardly
dynamic.
There's hardly ever anything to laugh at in one of those, like, disaster porn movies where it's just like, you know, let's see how much we can destroy the Earth. They're always, like, super serious, especially big summer blockbuster sci-fi movies always tend to be very dark and serious. I mean, Aliens kind of falls in that, you know, up until this point, if you're doing, like, a big alien invasion movie, with the exception of Mars Attacks, most time take themselves very, very seriously.
Holy shit, I forgot about Mars Attacks. yeah.
but this one did an excellent job of balancing that, you know, life or death situations. I mean, it had its sad moments. But like I said, overall, it was a fun movie.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I don't know, man. Like, there's so many action movies today that I still end up drawing a comparison to Independence Day because I remember how I felt seeing this movie. And each time I go back and watch the movie, like you said, you know, you have kind of that roller coaster. So you're up and you're down, but it's not so serious that, like, you leave the theater depressed or anything. Like, it's a good time.
It had all those, like, great, you know, just one-liners and just, you know, stand-up and cheer moments.
I mean, the other thing, as a cigar nerd, man, there's a lot of cigars featured
yes,
in this film, and
that's
one of the other highlights.
Wanted to talk about briefly. Yeah, because we kind of always talk about, like, we're going to do, like, a cigar, like, you know, top 10 cigar movies episode that we've not got around to. But when I was doing research on this, I came across a lot of articles that kind of, if anyone remembers, like, cigar culture in the 90s, that's when what we all refer to now as the cigar boom, when, like, cigars came from something kind of underground or something your grandpa did to something huge that, you know, everybody was doing. And a lot of people credit this movie as, you know, starting that or contributing to that. And as it turns out that back then, a lot of cigar manufacturers were basically operating on kind of like a stealth advertising campaign where they went and, like, paid Hollywood to, hey, feature cigars in your movies. And, like, they don't even have to be branded, just feature cigars, which is what occurred in this movie. Like, there's literally almost a cigar reference in just about every few minutes.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, I don't know. Like, you think of cigars now, or, you know, even back then, it was more of a celebratory thing, right? So, you know, it's almost like earning your rite of passage.
Well,
so,
yeah, you start off with... once the aliens arrive and Will Smith gets recalled, you have the scene where his squadron's preparing to attack and they're all passing out a box of cigars. And it's like, that's your victory dance. Once the mission is over, we all fire one up. And his like commander that ran the base that he was based out of, El Toro, dude's got a cigar in his mouth like the entire movie. Even like Jeff Goldblum's father, played by Judd Hirsch, he's like, constantly got like a cigar and toward the end of the movie when they're going to go up and blow up the alien mothership, you know, Wilson's like, dude, we can't fly unless we have a cigar, you know, it's going to curse the whole mission. And those cigars were like I said, cigar companies were paying Hollywood to include their products in their movies. The tube cigars from the pilot briefing scene were Baring Imperials, and then all the other unbranded cigars you see out through the rest of the movie were all provided by J.C. Newman, the one who made the Brickhouse Traveler, and they're all Coustarets.
Yeah, and then, you know, I can remember, you know, the Coustarets being out there for a while. I haven't seen them recently, so I don't know if they've been retired or what, but, I thought it would have been kind of cool, you know, if we could have actually found that cigar, but...
Yeah, I've not seen one in a store recently. When I found that article about that, I went and looked them up, and... They're still available online, so they got to be in shop somewhere.
There's one cigar shop that comes to mind that we can probably still find them at, but...
The one that we're pretty sure is a cover for a drug operation?
Yes, that one. It's like the quantity of dust outnumbers the cigars in their humidor.
So we get a couple days off. You know, we usually try to travel around and hit different cigar shops and see what's... out there, especially if we're out of town on something. And we found this one little hole-in-the-wall cigar shop one day. And I swear, everything in the humidor had about an inch of dust on it. And they had stuff in there that I know has not been manufactured in, like, a decade. And they still had, like, boxes of it, because I don't think anyone ever came into the shop to actually buy cigars.
Vintage cigar shop. Vintage.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm pretty sure if we went to that, you know, extra door in the humidor, we would have found, like, the pot grow operation.
Or something. Who knows? But
it's a meth house.
Leave it alone. All right, back on topic.
But yeah, the original Independence Day too. I think another thing that made that movie so huge was the marketing campaign. Because, you know, nowadays you see a trailer for a movie, you almost know what the movie's entirely about before you ever sit down in the seats. You at the very least know who's in the movie. But the original trailers for Independence Day, like, did not have a single star in the trailer. Like, it just showed a couple of scenes of the destruction of the aliens arriving. You know, that epic scene that's been repeated in... Hell, it was even repeated in Austin Powers, of the blowing up of the White House. I mean, it was just a few scenes of destruction, and it's like, you know, we thought we were alone... On July 4th, we'll wish we were alone.
Yeah, you know, I'm trying to think back. You know, it's been so long that I don't remember a whole of the marketing. But to your point, like this, the trailers, they left a lot to the imagination. They didn't try to throw out the entire storyline. Like, gave you enough to have that oh shit moment and to build that anticipation.
We know there's aliens. We know shit's going to get blown up. That's pretty much all you knew from that original trailer.
And it was also cool, too, you know, the fact that when this film was released, a lot of, you know, theaters started actually showing it on July 2nd, which is when the movie took place. So, yeah. You know, it was kind of cool that, you know, as these events are happening, you know, you could almost, you know, follow that same time frame real time. Like, I've been really tempted to, like, start the movie on July 2nd. You know, pause, wait till July 3rd, you know, and let it bleed over.
Just use the whole holiday weekend. Yeah, because I know I went back and watched the original teaser trailer just to make sure I was remembering it correctly. And yeah, all it has is some of the destruction scenes. You don't see any of the main characters, and it's like July 2nd they arrived, July 3rd they attacked, and July 4th we fight back, Independence Day. And like I said, this was, you know, had a lot of famous people in it that, like, if this trailer came out today, you would have seen every single one of them. And I don't think I even knew Will Smith was in this movie until maybe a few weeks before the release, when we got, like, the full trailer. Because, I mean, Bill Pullman, Will Smith, Jeff Goldblum, Judd Hirsch, like, you know, pretty big-name actors, which, you know, normally, they would hype the shit out, because that's how they get people to see a movie, is like, come see this. It has Will Smith. It has this guy. It has this guy. Come, you know. But then it was just like, no. Like, here's what the movie's about. It's about shit getting blown up. That's all you need to know.
Yeah, you're not quite sure you know what you're going to get into. Is it a disaster film? Is it an action film? You know, exactly what's taking place. So it left a lot to the imagination, which I think, like you said, you know, the trailers today, they just put it all out there and... You know, then it's like, well, there's not much left. Like, I guess that's one reason why I enjoy reading books, is because, you know, the writer has a path they're taking you on, but there's enough to the imagination that you can, you know, take other, you know, paths as well.
Yeah, so. Yeah. I mean, if you judge that movie based solely on that original trailer, you would have assumed it was a much darker film than it was until, like, the actual trailer came out and it kind of showed it was a little bit... A little bit lighter mood, you know. It wasn't just, you know, we're going to get wiped out by aliens, you know. It's, you know, but yeah, that, and also, directed by, Roland, Emmerich, which you may know from another movie. He was the one who directed the original Stargate movie.
Yes. And that's, you know, as I was watching, this film and the other film, like, there were certain things that I felt like, you know, were kind of taken directly out of Stargate and, you know, flipped into Independence Day. Like,
yeah,
there were correlations there.
Yeah, I know, because, like, when I we'll talk about more when we get into the second movie, but at one point they go to the Cheyenne Mountain Complex, and I'm just like, oh, shit, they're going to Stargate Command. And Emmerich even said that Stargate was kind of a... inspiration for this movie, because I think he was on tour promoting Stargate when someone kind of asked him, like, what would you think if, you know, aliens actually came to Earth, what would happen? And it kind of inspired him to start kind of writing the script of an, you know, and, you know, his version of an alien invasion movie.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm just glad that this film was so successful too. I mean,
yeah,
was,
I mean,
what, you know, one of the highest grossing, or, you know, still ranks as one of the highest grossing films. I think it's like 55th now.
Yeah, it was the number one movie in 1996. Because, like I said, $75 million budget, made $117 million worldwide. I mean, that first movie just was huge. Even got two, you know, Academy Awards for Best Visual Effects and Best Sound Mixing, which... Yeah, big sci-fi movies usually don't get any kind of, you know, Academy recognition.
No, but I mean, you know, that was one of the things that I think was so, you know, awesome about this, is it was visually appealing. And then, I mean, I can remember this being one of the films that I was like, no, I've got to, you know, when the freaking, it actually came to home video. Yeah, that was the first time I can remember actually upgrading my home sound system, you know, because I wanted to replicate what I had heard in the theater, you know.
Oh, yeah, that when those, you know, the mothership shows up and then it breaks off with the little, you know, city destroyer ships. Just that bass sound of that thing, like, passing over the city and everything's kind of shaking. Yeah, it's, seeing that in the theater with that, you know, high-end sound system is just... You know, it's so much different than trying to watch it on video now, because, like, you're literally like the theater's rumbling as this giant ship, which is the ones that came into the atmosphere to blow up the cities were 15 miles, you know, in diameter, which, you know, cover up most of a good downtown portion of the city, and just that scale. I mean, when they arrive, you know, and of course Will Smith's character is a Marine fighter pilot, Captain Stephen Hillard. You know, it starts off, he's supposed to be on, like, you know, break for Independence Day. He's, like, you know, at home with his girlfriend and Vivica A. Fox, which is one of her first movies. And he just like steps outside to get the paper, and like all the neighbors are packing up, and he's like, "What the fuck's going on?" And, like, looks up and sees that giant thing covering
you just see like the
downtown LA. Like, yeah. It was like, I mean, just the scale of the sheer size of those things were just so impressive to not look fake. You know, to pull off that, you know, that visual image without making it look like, you know, Doctor Who spaceships on a string.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, not to downplay Doctor Who. I mean, they've done some pretty sweet shit. But, yeah, no, like, you truly, you know, felt like the despair, you know? And, yeah. But,
I mean, it truly, at least for the first two-thirds of the movie, looked like a hopeless endeavor. Yes. Like, how can we fight something that's, that, like, our weapons don't make a dent in, that's so, so far technologically advanced than us, and you know it's up to a cable repairman and a pilot to save us all.
Yeah, that's I love the you know the running pun between you know Goldblum and his father, and his father you know just basically giving him shit about you know being a
he's like, you went to MIT, you became a cable repairman.
Yes,
it's like that's not what I do, Dad.
Not at all. Like. Way to over simplify all the grand achievements I've made.
Yeah, and like, let's talk about Goldblum's character for a minute. David Levenstein, who starts out as basically works for like a big cable network. He's a MIT graduate, satellite technician, and he's pretty much the only one smart enough to realize what's going on. He discovers this signal in the ships that's. Yep. He's like, oh shit, this is a countdown.
Yes.
And they're positioning themselves to take over. So he like tries to flee and go to the White House to save his ex-wife and tell everyone, hey, this isn't ET. These aren't friendly. We need to get the fuck out of here.
Yeah, we need to be doing something, you know? And I don't know, man. Like, I was really excited to learn that Jeff was going to be in this movie because I remember, you know, from Jurassic Park. You know, Jurassic Park was really the film that put Jeff Goldblum on my map. Yeah. You know, and I loved his character then. You know, he's kind of a you know, I love his witty kind of smart ass. Yeah. Like, you know, that's
he's
the kind of guy I want to have a beer with.
Yeah, you can tell he's the smartest man in the room without him being a dick about it. You know. He's just so, like, you know, just, you know, even though, like, the world is completely screwed, I mean, he's still, like, you know, trying to explain stuff. And like, no, we got to get the hell out of here, Mr. President. And then that whole, Judd Hirsch, who's, I mean, he's been in stuff forever, like, all the way back to the original Taxi, and it's always hilarious, but his interactions where he's just, like, the everyday man that's kind of dragged into all this stuff because, like, his son didn't have a car, so he had to drive him to the White House. And then he gets caught up with, you know, them all fleeing the, you know, in Air Force One as we get that epic, you know, shot of the White House getting blown up. And him just like, y'all knew this was coming. Y'all captured that alien ship, what, back in 1942? Roswell, Area 51, y'all knew this was coming. And the president, played by Bill Pullman, this is probably one of his greatest roles that you will always be known as President Whitmore, is in my book anyway, that or Lone Star from Spaceballs. He's like, you know, sir, no matter what, you know, the tabloids have told you, we have never captured an alien. And then like the Secretary of Defense is like, well, sir, that's not entirely true. And then we get, you know, everyone's favorite, you know, government conspiracy theory, Area 51.
Yeah, and it was kind of cool, you know, the depths that it takes you into Area 51 and everything else. Like, not only did we capture alien life form, but we have their ships, we have all of these other things. Like, you know, it really kind of makes you wonder what is actually going on at Area 51 today.
Yeah, I do like that the commander of the base is, was it David Baldwin? One of the Baldwins from Firefly, who's been in a whole bunch of stuff. But yeah, you know, seeing him in back in action, who is definitely...
Yeah, it was Adam Baldwin.
Yeah, Adam Baldwin. I can't believe there's too many Baldwins, man. They all get confused. But yeah, him is the leader of that base. I'm like, hell yeah. Now there's going to be some badassery going on. And then, of course, another person who's quite familiar with aliens, Brent Spiner, Data from Star Trek The Next Generation, playing Dr. Brackish Oaken, the lead scientist of Area 51.
And the whole time this going on, I'm trying so hard not to refer to the guy as Data.
Oh, and it's so badass. Him just is freaking crazy as hell, because you can tell this dude's probably been like lead scientist since the 70s and has not left the base at all.
No.
In fact, at one part he even says, like, they don't let us out much. I mean, this guy's like uber nerd. Like, you know, everyone else is freaking out for the alien invasion, and he's like super excited because he's like, all these things are turning on. This is like a really exciting time.
It's a breakthrough in science. Too bad nobody's going to live to tell about it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And then, of course, Will Smith's character. And that first, like, so this movie was almost, could stand up with Top Gun and some, like, the great fighter pilot movies. Because that, those original, like, scenes with him and his wingman, which was Harry Connick Jr. for some reason, dogfighting aliens. I'm like, this could be a movie just by itself. Just like a freaking Top Gun. This is what I wanted to see out of the Rogue One movie.
Yes.
Fucking Top Gun in space. I mean, dogfights with alien ships flying, you know, F-18 Hornets. I mean, it was, I think that's what they were flying. It's been a while. F-18s or F-16s. I mean, they were tearing shit up. But yeah, and then Will Smith gets in that whole like Death Star trench run chase through the Grand Canyon while he's getting followed by the alien, and ends up like, you know, sacrificing his ship and taking out the alien, and that whole thing with like, you know, like beats the hell out of the alien and like is dragging it through the desert in his parachute and is just like cussing it the whole way. It's like, nah, I could have, you know, it's holiday weekend. Y'all had to come down here being all big and bad. And now I'm dragging your ass to the desert with your dreadlocks hanging out. I could have been at a barbecue. Yes. Just kicking the shit out of it.
I don't know.
Smoking his cigar.
I mean, I still love, you know, when he first, you know, sees the alien and, you know, punches him in the face and just like, welcome to Earth, motherfucker. I mean, like,
that is straight America right there. I mean, that just shows
you, you know, the resilience.
Yeah, it's like, you know. You get a Marine fighter, but there's no like, oh crap, there's an alien. It's just like, bam, just immediately. Just, where most people probably crap their pants. He's like, nope, just gut reaction. I'm going to punch this thing in the face.
For better or for worse, it's going down. Like, I don't know, man. Like, you know, I think that was one of the things that, you know, just the, you know, resounding resilience and everything, you know, the unimaginable odds and, you know, like, we look at everything going on in the world today and, you know, I think back to, you know, major events and shit like that and, you know, like, it would really take something like that to bring people together, yeah. You know, and...
Because you really see that once they come up with the plan that, oh, we're going to infect the mothership. We're going to fly a ship up, infect the mothership with a virus that will kill the shields. And then, like, you know, we start telling the rest of the world about this plan. And you see all these nations that, like, absolutely hate each other. You know, they're together, like, you know, oh, we have a common enemy. Like, you know, this is, like, 96. We weren't exactly, you know, great friends with certain countries, but you see like the Germans, the Russians, you even see like in the Middle East, like the Israelis and the Iranians, like working together, like, you know.
Yeah, well, I mean, at the end of the day, what do you have in common? We're all humans.
And we're all going to die.
So you strip away all the labels and all the other bullshit and, you know, it becomes a matter of survival. So, you know, from that aspect, like, I thought it was really kind of cool how it, you know, ultimately brought everybody together, you know, instead of it just being, you know, one nation basically going through and taking care. No, like, this is a worldwide global effort. And, Yeah. You know, to see humanity, you know, in that sense, like, you know, it really makes you think.
And Randy Quaid as Russell Case, the kind of like, you know, a prequel to what really happened to Randy Quaid when he went batshit crazy. But he's like this Vietnam pilot that got abducted by aliens, or at least he claims, and everyone thinks he's insane. Alcoholic crop duster, ends up having to, you know, become the hero.
You dusted the wrong field. Yeah, because when they goes to right field, how do you think you're gonna, you know, freaking go up and battle aliens?
Yeah, because like, you know, so many professional pilots got wiped out in that first encounter that we needed, like, pretty much if you can fly, you know, you're signed up. Let's go. And, you know, he ends up becoming the hero, going from the, you know, comic relief to the big hero of the movie. And then, you know, Bill Pullman's speech in this movie is probably one of the greatest movie speeches of all time. Just
to, no, yeah. I mean, this is one that you still hear today, you know, even. Like, I hear snippets from films and everything, and I can't tell you, you know, how many different times I've heard that, you know, speech come up.
Oh, yeah, it's like, you know, if we succeed today, this will no longer be known as an American holiday. I mean, yeah, we'll probably play that as one of our intros or outros one, because, yeah, that's that move, that speech is just, like I said, it made so many lists of greatest movie, you know, battle speeches of all time.
You know what's crazy to me? Like, I've listened to so many presidential speeches and everything else, and I'm like, you know, where are the fucking writers, like, writing for the president and stuff? Like, we come up with these badass speeches for the movies and stuff. Why isn't actual presidents and world leaders coming up with this shit?
Yeah, they need,
like,
to start hiring Hollywood script writers instead of political speech writers. maybe we, like, could actually, you know, get behind them.
You know, it's bad when I get more motivated, you know, by a movie speech than what I do, you know, when our own president addresses the nation or something.
I mean, like, that speech from Patton. I mean, that's, like I said, that fires me up more than anything I've heard from an actual president. Which, and I did like the kind of the path of Jeff Goldblum's character in this movie, where he started off as, life was good enough. Like, he didn't really have any ambition. Like, you know, the dude was like an MIT graduate, could probably do anything, but he's working for a cable company. He's like kind of a hippie dude trying to save the planet and bitching about recycling and shit.
Yeah, I mean, he's more the environmental, like, I mean, when you got that kind of knowledge, like, what's your challenge, really?
Yeah.
You know, I mean.
And then, like I said, when he comes up with this plan for the, you know, to take out the mothership, you know, he has to kind of step up and be, you know, the hero. And it's like, you know, why does that have to be you? He's like, well, you're always saying I should do more with my life. Yeah.
I'm taking your advice. Like, damned if I do, damned if I don't.
Oh, yeah. And Will Smith's character, who always wanted to join NASA, but couldn't get in. He finally gets to fly into space. And then, like, that whole thing where they get up there and the ship gets taken over and he's in the middle of, like, uploading that virus and they're having to hide from the aliens. And you pretty much think, like, oh, it's, the plan is fucked. Like, you know, and so they're, like, you know, pulling out their cigars, smoking their cigars, like it's, you know, the world's over. And then they're like, all right, you ready? Yep. Beep, hit the button, and they all get up and like, hey, look at the humans. Freaking launch that nuclear missile into them and blow the whole thing up. And like when they land all over, like, you know, they've crashed the ship in the desert and everybody comes out to greet them and they're just walking through the desert smoking cigars like badasses. And even his father, because like I said, he's always been the super hippie guy. They're like, oh, you're smoking cigars now. Is this healthy? He's like, probably not, but I could get used to it.
Yes.
It's like, I just saved the world. I'm going to smoke me a stogie.
That is awesome. I mean, you know, it was those moments that just brought over, you know, I don't know, man. The movie genuinely made you feel compelled, and it made you feel good at the same time.
Yeah. Like, I mean, America, fuck yeah.
Different movie altogether.
But still the same feeling. Yes. And like I said, it got you fired up. You're like, you know, wish some aliens would show up so we could kick some ET ass.
Oh. But yeah, I mean, there's not too many movies, you know, that bring about that sense that you get from this, so I don't know. I mean, it's, like I said, I just still can't believe there was a 20-year gap. But, you know, as we segue into talking about, you know.
And I think that's one of the reasons why it made that movie particularly impactful is there wasn't an immediate sequel. You know, this is like, today, like I said, if something's successful, they're going to immediately try to capitalize on that.
Oh, yeah, within a year, you've got it. You know,
it's going to be a trilogy. Nothing.
You've got a board game. You've got some kind of drink named after it. You've got, you know.
Which it did, like, have a lot of marketing stuff. But, yeah, they never did make another movie. I remember, because when this came out, I was working at Walmart. And they released a toy of those aliens. and it was motion sensor activated. So when you walked by, the little face would like open up and you could see the little alien side of it and make this like weird like screaming sound. And there was a whole like shelf, like an end cap full of those damn things. And anytime someone would walk by, every single one of them would go off. It was the most annoying sound in the world. Like we'd go and put tape over all the sensors just so they wouldn't go off. And then I'd go through and peel them all off just to be a dick and annoy the people that worked in toys.
Including yourself.
Yeah, it was worth it. Yeah. And that's something, the aliens in this movie too were...
Yeah, it's crazy. The aliens themselves... Pretty much harmless, like, you know, like, it's the, you know, freaking exo, you know, badass skeleton that you see that's the danger, like.
Yeah, once you cut them open, they look a lot like what we all think of, you know, the stereotypical alien design.
I have flashbacks to Men in Black.
Yeah, with the tentacles. But I gotta say, that first, where we first see an alien face-to-face with, when they're trying to autopsy the alien, it turns out it's not quite dead yet and like knocks everybody out. And he's using, cause these things don't speak. They communicate telepathically. So they're using Dr. Oaken kind of as a meat puppet to talk to us. And that scene when like they all come inside to see the alien and the room is just full of like smoke and you can't see anything through the smoke. And they're all like looking, all of a sudden his face just gets slammed up against the glass. That scared the shit out of me when I was a kid. It's like, oh shit. And then you start, you know, the president's trying to question him. He's like, you know, I'm sure we can find some common ground. Can there be peace? And it's like, no peace. They're like, well, what do you want? Die. It's like, oh, shit. It's like, and that whole scene where, like, the president's getting, like, attacked, like, telepathically, and the, whatever, Secretary of Defense, or whoever General Gray was playing, he's like, is this glass bulletproof? He's like, no, sir. And they all just shoot the fuck out of the alien. It's like, America.
Which is crazy because they pull out their handguns. Like, out of all the arsenal and everything else, it's your sidearm that you're using. Like, I would like to think I would be armed a little bit more to the teeth.
Yeah, there's aliens around here. I'm carrying like a freaking M60. Like, give me a Mod Deuce.
Taking out everything.
Yeah. Oh, but then that leads us to 20 years later, Independence Day Resurgence. Which I'm so surprised they didn't reboot this movie, like the way they freaking reboot everything else.
Which I am really glad. Like, I think had they had tried to do a full-on reboot, like, you know, I haven't really read much of, you know, what all the big-name critics are saying. I'll say that the, you know, Rotten Tomatoes score was like a 50 or something like that. So, you know, this movie has gotten some hate, but... You know, I gotta say, like, I went into this movie not really expecting anything, and I walked out like, damn, you know, that was a good summer blockbuster film. Yeah, like, I mean, you know, it wasn't overly heavy, it had its light moments, and it's what I envisioned, you know, blockbuster films being without everything being a damn reboot.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm surprised it didn't get you know, them making a sequel this late in the game just... I mean, almost like they did with Jurassic Park. I mean, it's cool that they did not try to, you know, reboot everything. Critics has been ripping in a new one, but like I said, I thought it was a fun movie. I mean, it may not have the gravitas of the original, but it was still a damn good, you know, good effort. Yeah, it was, like I said, it's not so far. Like I said, it's only been out, you know, a week or so. It's not made the money that the first one did, but I could see this one getting a big cult following.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I look and, you know, what did we have? We had Finding Dory, you know, I mean, everybody, you know, taking all their kids and even a lot of the adults that, you know, from the original Finding Nemo are like, you know, gravitating toward that. So I think that movie may have, you know, taken some of the steam away from this, but I think, like you said, what we're going to see is maybe not necessarily the blockbuster success, but when this comes out on home video,
yeah.
I think that's where...
Then I think there was like some confusion about when it was coming out, too, because you name a movie Independence Day, you expect an Independence Day release. This came out on June 24th. To me, that was not a good plan.
No, I think they should have waited, you know, to that... Like they did with the first one, you know, that July 2nd, July 3rd, and let that have been the release date.
Yeah, even if it had come out that, you know, since, you know, 4th of July was on a Monday this year, you know, if they'd have released it the Friday before, you know, that June 30th, I still think that would have been a better release date than what they planned on.
But, you know, at first I was a little bit concerned. I was like, how the hell are they going to do Independence Day without Will Smith? So I guess we'll go ahead and, you know, say spoiler alert, we're going to start getting into this film. So, you know.
Pause. Okay, fuck, well,
all right, so as we get into it, I guess, you know, spoiler alert, you know, because, yeah, I got to say, like we saw with the Jurassic Park films, they weren't entirely reboots. They paid homage to the originals and everything, and I felt like Independence Day Resurgence very much did that same thing. Like, you know, this is great for people that may not have seen the first Independence Day, so you can still grasp what's going on and get the concept. But, you know, for the true fans, this was also, you know, a film that paid homage to that first one, so it wasn't like, you know, we completely blew out and changed the game and the characters and the feel of the movie.
And like you were saying that, you know, how could they do this movie without Will Smith? But I didn't really miss him that much. I mean, there was enough homage to that character where they came out with a website called Battle 1996. I think if you Google it, you can find it, where it's basically they tried to put in a bunch of fake, you know, news articles and stuff and kind of explaining the timeline of what has occurred between the original movie and now. And basically, like, I think when we sit down to watch it, you know, Brad was like, what year does this take place? I'm like, it takes place now. He's like, we don't have fucking spaceships. And it's like, basically, like, we spent the last 20 years preparing for, you know, now that we know that there's threats out there, we've spent the last 20 years preparing for those threats by, you know, the technologically. There we go. Advancements we came up with by studying the original tech from the first movie, the aliens that invaded. So now we've got stuff that, you know, looks almost like a F-22 Raptor mixed with a, you know, X-Wing or something. You know, all our technology has been upgraded.
We got fucking vastly. Space toads.
The freaking towboats.
Yeah, the tugs, you know, like when they land and everything with the two arms. I'm like, damn.
And I said, in the in those articles from that website, they mentioned that Will Smith's character was killed in a training accident when they were first, like, you know, testing these new ships. And they even say it in the movie when they, because, you know, kind of, I like how they kind of pass the torch along. Because if you remember the original movie, Will Smith had a stepson and the president had a little daughter. And both of them are now 20 years older. And they're kind of the stars of the movie where, and instead of being
the protege,
it's a different Captain Hillard. Instead of Captain Stephen Hillard, now it's Captain, you know, Jacob Hillard, his stepson, his grand. And when he goes to meet the president, you know, there's a nice oil painting of Will Smith in his, like, flight suit from the first movie, because he's pretty much, you know, a national hero. Our big, you know, Area 51 has been turned into the Earth Space Defense, like, which basically all the nations of the world came together. We're all now one people preparing for this alien battle. So, like, it's a very mixed country, mixed origins, you know, military force. And, you know, Area 51 has kind of become their base, and even that base is named after, you know, Captain Hillard.
Yeah, and, you know, so that, you know, the, like I said, this gave everything that I wanted, you know, out of a summer blockbuster. And, you know, even though that people are calling this a box office disappointment and everything else, I still feel like this is one of those films that you should see in theaters. I mean, the sheer scope, like, you know, we were talking about, you know, the first movie, you know, the ships come in, they're 15 miles. Like, these ships now are so much more massive that without seeing it on that big screen, you don't really get that perception.
Because the little ships that actually, well, there was the big mothership up in space, and then the little ships came down to Earth, which I said was like 15 miles long. The ship that shows up in this one is 3,000 miles across. It's the size of a country.
Yes. So, I mean, you know, the sheer scope and magnitude of what you're going to be up against in this film is, you know, ever prevalent. So, I don't know. Like I said, I feel like, you know, people are really missing out if you don't see this film in theater. And this is another one that, you know, I think visually was very well done. But then, too, you know, the sound and the score of the film, you know, was no less, you know, disappointing than the first film.
Yeah, the first film, like, the special effects was revolutionary. And now we've had 20 years to build on that technology to, I mean, now it looks, it's so high-tech looking, but it looks realistic. Like, I didn't think this was, like, a bunch of CGI crap.
No,
I mean,
like, it's still believable.
Yeah. And just like the, and like I said, they really, since we've kind of advanced our weaponry and stuff, like, if it was the same level of threat we had in the first movie, I don't think we'd had any problem taking out the aliens. So they had to, like, step up that thresh level.
Well, I mean, you know.
To, again, make it feel like it's overwhelming odds. Like, I even mean, though we're so more military and technologically advanced than we were the first time they invaded, like, it still had that feel of, like, we're doomed.
Well, I mean, here's the thing, right? We had 20 years to prepare. Guess what? So did the enemy. So, you know, like, I really like the whole fact that it came out in, you know, this whole hive. So all the ships are, you know, related to the central queen. And, you know, to me, it almost, you know, goes back to some of the alien, you know, feel to it, where you always had, you know, the head queen and everybody else is just, you know, the workers, so to speak. So,
and we'll get to that queen here in a minute because, her reveal is...
Yes.
That's a surprise. But, yeah. Again, like I said, at this point, David's character is now the head, basically the civilian head of the ESD. And with the general, what's his name? Guy's been in a bunch of movies. William Fitner playing Joshua Adams, who is basically the military head of the ESD, and he's cool as shit. Dude's like been in so many freaking movies. But yeah, you see, you know, now it's been, like I said, so many years that we've had a couple presidents, you know, between him, but you know, old man bearded version of President Whitmore, and everybody still like calls him Mr. President and like treats him like, even though you're not the president anymore, you are the world leader because you saved our asses.
Yeah.
And there's one scene where we're having, like, the aliens invade right as we're having our 20th anniversary of the Battle of 1996, like, celebration. And the current president's giving a big speech. And there is General Gray from the first movie who is, like, I almost didn't recognize him because he's gotten so much older since then. And this, I think, was actually his last movie because he you know, passed away before this movie came out. But yeah, he was there. And apparently, like, if you look at some of the background of the what happened in the last 20 years, he was actually the president after Whitmore. Like, when Whitmore's term was over, he became the next president. And, you know, eventually the lady president, played by Celia Ward. So yeah, it was kind of cool that, you know, even though he was in a condition where he couldn't play a big part in the movie, having him just there at the, you know, celebration, and, you know, Bill Pullman kind of giving him like a little, you know, nod, salute, you know, when he comes up on stage, it was kind of cool, you know, them paying that tribute to his character.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, I don't know. You know, once again, that speech was moving, you know. Everybody's anticipating, you know, another renowned speech, and it's like, no, I'm here to warn you.
Like, we're fucked. Yeah. Like,
this is all bad.
Yeah. And this also has, you know, President Whitmore's daughter is now, like, you know, basically a press secretary, but she was a pilot herself who left the Air Force to help take care of her father as he got kind of older. And there's a whole thing of, like, people that kind of fought this war, that their brains kind of connected to that alien hive. They're having visions with this, like, symbol that, like, oh shit, something's coming. Like, and this alien ship shows up, and we immediately blow it up, and we probably
against,
shouldn't have, because it was,
you know, Jeff Goldblum's.
He's like, we don't know. This is not them. This doesn't look like their technology. We should see who it is. This may be, you know, friendly people.
And it was weird, too, because if you count the votes to hold back far outweighed the votes to attack immediately. Like, you had, like, 7 people that said, we should hold back. You had 3 that said, fire immediately.
And, of course, the president says, blow him out of the sky. And it's kind of, I swear, that ship, when it showed up, it kind of reminded me of the big smiley face spaceship from Heavy Metal with the stoned aliens.
Yes. I once again, I kind of had flashbacks to Alien, Stargate, and Heavy Metal, you know, all within this film.
Yeah, like I said, you know, being made by the same guy who made Stargate, like I said, I really felt like this could have been an episode of Stargate at one point, like the TV show, especially when they start showing the, you know, our advanced fighters and stuff. It kind of reminded me of those later seasons of, you know, the Stargate SG-1 TV show where we had, like, space fighters and our own big intergalactic ships that kind of looked like flying aircraft carriers and stuff. I mean, they even go to the Cheyenne Mountain Complex and, like, all right, they're going to Stargate Command.
Yes.
Where's Colonel O'Neill?
And you're almost waiting on some of that stuff. And that was kind of the, you know, one of the other things I found interesting is you don't just have one race of aliens now. You do have, you know, the race that, you know, everybody, they've seen the symbol. And, you know, we're speaking of the characters. You know, one of the biggest characters I thought was awesome was the guy that plays the freaking African warlord.
Dikembe Mobutu is the character's name.
Like, dude, he had some awesome lines. Like,
yeah, because, I mean, it kind of starts off, Goldblum's character goes out to this small country in Africa where basically after the aliens all crash-landed, these guys fought like a 10-year ground war against, like, you know, the alien remnants. And, you know, these guys really, you know, African warlords, but they kicked some aliens' ass and actually, you know, kind of deciphered some of their language and their technology because they're like, you know, hey, they were hunting us, so we had to learn about them so we could more efficiently hunt them.
Yep.
So when the first alien crashes and Goldblum's like, we got to go check this out, he's like, I'm coming too. And he's like, I'll let you in my country. You should repay the favor. Because basically, they were very isolationist and they, like, didn't want anybody in their country to examine this crashed alien ship that was drilling into the earth for some reason. We don't know why yet. But, you know, the leader of that country died and his son took over. And so this is like the first time we're getting a look at this kind of piece of the puzzle. So he's like, you let me in, now I come with you.
And it was just awesome, too. I mean, you know, it's just the wielding of the double machetes and, you know, his whole speech of, no, you got to get them from the rear.
Like, that's the thing. The nerdy, typical government bureaucrat who's like basically an accountant that's following around harassing Goldblum, his voyage as a character was so, I mean, he starts off as the comic relief. He's like completely out of his element. He's like, I'm an accountant and here we are dealing with aliens. But then, like, as it goes on, he's like, teach me to be a warrior. And they're like,
teach me everything you know.
Yeah. Like after they get back from, like, the big alien ship shows up, and then, which is kind of cool because they did that whole destruction of the major cities thing they did in the original movies, but they did it completely different. This thing has, like, basically a gravity weapon where it just kind of, like, sucks up all these cities in, like, Asia, and then when it gets to Europe, it kind of drops all the buildings and stuff and levels Europe. And Goldblum even makes the joke when they take out, I think it's, like, the famous bridge in England. It's like, they always go for the monuments. As stuff's getting blown up and crushed. And, like, after that, you know, there's this whole epic scene of all the fighter jets leaving to attack the ship. And that, like, accountant guy just throws his briefcase in the garbage can. He's like, all right, give me one of your katanas and teach me everything you know. And he's like, no. And he's like, fine, I'll find another way. Next time you see him, he's, like, all tacked out with, like, a laser rifle and shit. And he's like excited to be there to, like, you know, he's like, let's kill some aliens.
And just that whole, you know, the ending spill after the big battle is, you talk too much.
Yeah, they end up, like, you know, him and Mutombe, like, just, you know, goes and saves kill a whole bunch of aliens and stuff, and, like, and finally, like, after the battle's over with and stuff, he's like, finally admits to him, he's like, you have the heart of a warrior. It's like, that's the nicest thing anyone's ever said to me.
I have earned my man card.
Yeah, he's like a total nerd, but by the end of it, you know, he kind of has that, you know, mutual respect. Like, all right, I consider you a warrior now. You can hang out with me.
But I mean, it was some of those dynamics that I think really kept this film alive. It made it enjoyable, and, you know, the serious moments felt serious, and, you know, during the comic relief, it was genuine, funny, and lighthearted. And once again, I still just don't see what the negativity is behind the film.
Because everyone wants to be a hater these days.
I suppose.
And one of the things that, like, Dr. Oken, if we're talking about stuff from the original movie, apparently, like, I thought he was dead. Like, when you see him in the first movie, like, unconscious with his eyes is open, and, you know, he checks for a pulse, but never really say, like, oh, he's dead. And, like, I always assumed that he was fucking dead. But
yep.
Apparently, no, he was just, his brain was kind of vegetabilized from being in contact with aliens, and he's been in a coma for 20 years and just wakes up when the shit starts hitting the fan. And that whole, like, him, like, kind of a man out of time is hilarious. He, like, wakes up and he's like, did we win? And he's like, yeah, we won. And he's like, oh my God, you've gotten old and fat and bald. And he reaches up to check his own hair to see if he's like, yes, but you still look great, man. And him, like, whole running around, like, checking all the cool alien stuff, like, in, still in his, like, hospital gown with his tighty-whities on. And he's like, and then finally his partner is like, bro, yeah, I'm really glad you want to get back to work, but we should get you some pants before you start doing science stuff.
Why didn't you tell me my butt was hanging out?
And then they introduce the sphere, which is, like I said, I kept having flashbacks to Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. I don't know why, but it just reminded me something from that movie where, this there's other races out there fighting these aliens, and basically this is like the last living of the remnant of this other highly advanced society that basically could put their consciousness in these orbs, and like she's loaded with all kind of like weapons and future advancements and stuff, and it's the one threat to the aliens, so they're trying to find the orb. And the orb is like, yeah, I've been picking up survivors from these wiped out planets, and you know, I've started a planet where we're building a resistance to the aliens and stuff.
Yeah, and that's the thing. Like, you know, the queen is basically, whenever this orb gets activated, emits, you know, some kind of radioactive signal that the queen can pick up on, and, you know, basically she's trying to get all the knowledge, you know, since that's the threat, and, you know, wipe out the resistance planet and everything.
Which kind of reminds me of a you know, because when the orb first sees us, they're like, y'all are a primitive species. But by the end of the movie, where we have killed the queen against all odds, they're like, we want you to lead our resistance. And again, that was something that kind of reminded me of Stargate SG-1, because there was the, I can't remember, they called them the Ancients, which they looked exactly like what we consider like aliens. And they were this super advanced race that kind of were all clones of themselves and stuff, and had like this way, like, big technology. But one of the reasons they kind of made contact with us was the fact that, you know, they had advanced so far that they really couldn't come up with inventive ideas anymore. And they were fighting this alien race that was like, could basically co-opt anybody's technology and stuff. And like, we need a primitive warrior's mind. So they had to partner with the humans, because, like, you know, the humans are still unpredictable.
Yeah.
And we could fight these like computer-based aliens. So it's kind of as cool as like, all right, we're super advanced, but we can't think creatively anymore. We need, like, some, you know, gunslingers to help us.
Well, I mean, it's like you think about, you know, the governments today, like nuclear codes and stuff like that still being stored on floppy disk because they can't be hacked. You know, the computers are tied to aren't networked in with the other internet streams and stuff like that. Now, damn it if you have a magnet or something like that get too close, but... You know, it's funny how, you know, technology, no matter how advanced, always has, you know, kind of that downfall and that flaw.
I mean, you know, Death Star had a unsecured exhaust port.
And that was the other kind of cool thing is during the opening scenes of this movie, you see what looks like an old destroyed Death Star or something like that. You know, one of the ships that, you know... As the camera flies by, is what came to my head. I was like, "Oh shit, looks like a Death Star."
Yeah,
like that's almost what I'm thinking. Is, you know, we're gonna battle, you know, some kind of freaking Star Destroyer or something like that. And
I know, like when they got to that that first air battle with our new fighter jets that are all, you know, laser guns and all this other stuff. Like when they're coming up out of the base to go attack the ship, I swear it looked like, you know, them leaving Yavin base in the original Star Wars. I'm like, Lock S foils in attack position. And then when they got into the fight with the alien ships and stuff, I was like, holy shit, this looks like freaking Star Wars. Like,
yes. Like, it's what you wanted out of, you know, it's honestly, it's what I really hope out of Rogue One.
Like, yeah.
I really want to see Top Gun in space.
And this was almost that.
I want to see some of those dogs fights. You know, and that's, you know, the space battles were awesome. The ground battles were, you know, freaking great. I don't know that I, the fact that you got a school bus in the middle of the desert at Area 51, it's kind of weird to me.
Yeah.
Out of everything that you could have had, you got a damn school bus full of kids.
Yeah, that's, yeah, how they brought, Judd Hirsch's character back into it. But I kept wanting to see them do something.
Yeah.
Like, I'm like, all right, when we've President Whitmore blows up the alien queen's ship when we basically trap her into coming into Area 51. But turns out she had her own, like, shield generator, so the ship blew up, but she was still alive, and she's, like, freaking Godzilla-sized. I mean, it went immediately from a alien movie to a freaking kaiju movie. And I kept, while she's running around, like, you know, fighting off the jet fighters, I kept waiting for, like, that school bus to, like, trip her or something. I'm like, you don't bring in a school bus without giving it some, like, you know, point on the plot, other than just, shit, we gotta run from the alien.
But that was the only point of this school bus, was just to give you that perspective. But I mean, you know, as you're watching the, you know, the fighters come in to take out the queen, and the queen, you know, destroying all these tactical vehicles and making her way to the Earth Station defense base and everything, like, you know, seeing it from that perspective was, you know, kind of interesting.
Yeah, because I mean, showing it from the aerial views, you don't really get that sense of size, but seeing it from the man on the ground's perspective, you see really how huge that's a huge bitch.
Yeah, like, I mean, it gave it that truly menacing, but I don't know, like, you know, it almost kind of felt like Pacific Rim, you know, from that standpoint, once it became land-based.
That's what I'm waiting for, this, because supposedly now this is going to be a new trilogy of films, because, yeah, like,
so
I said,
we just need to wait another 20 years.
We've got invited to join the Resistance. I'm waiting for there to be like a Voltron in the next movie. Like, there's going to be some, you know, freaking Gypsy Danger is going to show up or something. Yeah. Now that we know that there's giant aliens, we got to prepare for that contingency. We need giant robots.
Yes. Oh, I don't know, man. The possibilities there are limitless. I mean, do we get Transformers? Like,
and I did enjoy some of the smaller references to the original movies, where it wasn't like, you know, and we had some of the original characters, but there's still like these tiny references, like when the president and the cabinet all get wiped out, and that while in Shyman, so they're attacked by these aliens and stuff. And like, as soon as they bust in, the president looks at them and is like, there will be no peace, you know, which is what the aliens said to us, like the first time around, you know, as they start, you know, trying to, you know, fight the aliens. And then you see there's another, what's his name? Jake, who is Liam Hemsworth. He's like another new pilot, but he and Dylan don't get along because he almost killed him in like a training mission where basically they were having a race to determine who was going to be the squadron commander. And they're racing through that same like Grand Canyon that you saw like Will Smith getting chased by the alien through in the first movie. You know, these little like small points where if you're not paying attention, you may miss it, but it was kind of cool. These little throwbacks.
Yes. Yeah, and I don't know, man. Like, I really like the dynamic between Liam Hemsworth and then, you know, also Will Smith's son.
Yeah, played by Jesse Usher.
Yep. You know, that was, you know, kind of that, at first, you know, opposing, you know, speaking of the you know, freaking canyon race, basically Liam ends up clipping Dylan's wing and, you know, causes Dylan to have to eject and essentially lose that race. So there's that animosity between those two.
Yeah, and he's like probably like one of the best, if not most reckless pilots, but now he's, instead of flying a fighter jet, he's sentenced to flying a tugboat, basically, on the moon base.
Which is weird because, I mean, you know, I saw a lot more of the fighter jets go down than what I ever saw the tugs.
Yeah, they should put some guns on those tugs.
Which, you know, it's funny the reference it's made that, like, no, we're perfectly safe. These things are pretty much like space tanks.
Yeah. Yeah, and so they initially kind of to hate each other, but they kind of come to respect each other.
Yeah, and it, you know, comes full circle, and then, you know, you start getting some of those feel-good moments and everything.
And the scene of Jake, because, like, they try to fly into the Queen ship, but it's a trap, and the whole squadron gets pretty much taken out, and now they're trying to fight their way through the insides of the ship. And he goes to distract the aliens while they steal some spaceships. And he just, like, comes out, and he's like, hey, guys, remember me? Like, gives him the finger, he's like, and he's like, takes a piss on their flight deck. He's like, I've been holding that in for a long time. I was just like, that's badass.
Yes. Like, I don't know. I kind of like the smart-ass, you know, reckless antics. I mean, you know, for this film, it worked.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of, you know, Star Wars references, if they, because I know they're, and I don't know if they've selected the new Han Solo and the Han Solo prequel films, but I think Liam Hemsworth would be an excellent Han Solo, because he had that cocky attitude. I mean, I could see him playing a young Han Solo, because he's reckless, and he knows he's the best, but at the same time, he's kind of, like, cocky and just, like, yeah. I mean, see him.
He's got the ego for it.
Yeah. I could see him behind the scenes of the Millennium Falcon talking shit, you know?
Absolutely.
Thor could be Chewbacca in
there. Oh, shit. And there's where the nerd ties in.
Yeah, he definitely had that, you know, attitude of, and even what's her name, Mick Monroe, who played Patricia Whitmore. She's definitely, you know, the Princess Leia character. I mean, she's, you know, at first kind of just the president's daughter, but she really steps up and is like a warrior on her own right in the movie. You know, she's, you know, up there in the fighter jets taking out aliens by the end of it herself. And like I said, he would be an excellent Han Solo. She could probably play a young Princess Leia.
Yeah. I don't know, man. Like, he might be onto something there, because I mean, they've already got the experience with a space movie and everything. So
yep.
I just hope it isn't too little too late. Cause I don't know. Or to see them come out and do some kind of, like, fan film or something like that, yeah. Even if it's not, like, an official Star Wars thing, I think could be awesome.
And, like, you know, even his relationship with Dylan, you know, where they don't really like each other at the beginning, and that's kind of how Han and Luke, when they first met, were kind of like, Han Solo was the experienced guy and thought, you know, freaking Luke's just a kid, and Luke thought Han was an asshole, but they eventually became, you know, brothers by the end of the...
Yeah. I don't know, man. Could be something. But yeah, I mean, I would encourage folks, if you haven't already, go out, check the movie. I don't know. For me, it's worth seeing on the big screen.
And one of my favorite side characters has got to be the Irish recovery crew.
It's like... You know, there's $100 million worth of gold on the bottom of this ship. We're not going anywhere. And, like,
yeah, 'cause basically,
you know, basically the government reaches out and it's like, hey, we need eyes on the alien and to know what they're doing. And you guys are there. And they're like, $100 million. And, like, you know, they kind of say it jokingly. And the, you know, federal official they're talking to comes back. It's like, all right, you got it. Agree.
Yeah, because originally they're supposed to be ordered out of there, but they're trying to recover this sunken gold that's $100 million worth of gold. But this alien ship literally covers the entire Atlantic Ocean nearly. So next thing you see, they're just, like, getting drunk because they're like, the world's about to end. We just lost $100 million. Like, fuck it. We're going to go out drunk as shit. I mean, we're Irish. And that guy comes and he's like, Captain, the government's on the line, and they want, you know, a ship to keep an eye on the progress of the alien ship, which is trying to mine the Earth, basically, and blow us up by stealing our core. And they're all like, psh. It's like, we're the only ship left in the area. He's like, yeah, tell them it'll cost them. We'll do it for $100 million. And they're all like, ha, ha, ha. He's like, done. He's like, oh, shit, we got to sober up now. Like, as soon as they say $100 million, they get, like super serious. Yeah.
The mood all changes. Man, money is a motivational force.
And I tell you, man, if one lesson to learn from this movie, if you're getting attacked by aliens, do not use a countdown. I don't know how many times this movie, there's like at least three times we're like, all right, we're going to counterattack. And 5, 4, oh crap, we got blown up.
No, they always start at 10. And by the time they make it to 3, like, no, start at 5. Like, or don't do a countdown. Just push the button.
Pull the damn trigger.
Do the thing. Like, we don't need to count to do the thing.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I was like, I don't know how many times that happened where they just, like, start counting down and then stuff gets blown up. Or the, what was it, the other one where, it wasn't the countdown. It was, they're like, the alien ship is going to breach the core in 6 minutes. We've got 6 minutes or we're all dead. And I'm like, let me start my stopwatch. And yeah, it took us about 10 minutes to kill the alien. Yeah, so I'm like, we should have been dead. I think those like clocks on that ship were just a little bit off.
Damn. That's Hollywood magic, man. Hollywood magic.
Yeah. And with, as we kind of wrap this up, what's your final thoughts on the movie and the final thoughts on this here cigar?
My final thoughts on the movie, I've said it and I'll say it again. You know, go out and see it. It is a good summer flick while you have the opportunity to see it on the big screen with the badass sound system. So I don't care if you've got a 60 or 70 inch TV and a good surround sound at home or whatever. Like, fucking get out there and go see it. Like, you know, people always bitch about reboots and, you know, they're sick of Hollywood not coming out with new, fresh ideas. Well, this is a new, fresh idea. Get out there and support it and make it worthwhile.
Yeah, they
because
didn't reboot
right
it.
Now, you know, they're considering, you know, this to be a box office flop. So,
yeah, like I said, and it's, they've set the key up to continue it as a trilogy or a whole new trilogy from here on out. So, if you want to see how this all ends, because next they want to go take the fight to the enemy in space. So, freaking some space Top Gun movie. I've been one.
Absolutely.
So, as the out of the new characters, who is there a highlight of your favorite of the new generation of Independence Day warriors?
I mean, Liam Hemsworth, you know, Jake Morrison really grew on me. You know, I kind of like that cocky, arrogant, egotistical, you know,
Han Solo-esque.
Han Solo, you know that, but also, I forgot his name again. The freaking African warlord dude.
Oh,
like,
Dikembe Mobutu.
Yeah, I mean, he was another awesome addition that really doesn't fit within the mix at all, but just became an absolute total badass. Like,
yeah, I would say out of the new group, like I said, I did like Liam's character, but yeah, him and the accountant Floyd, their just dynamic between those two are absolutely hilarious.
I mean, it gave you that like almost buddy cop vibe,
yeah,
in a sense.
And even
like,
you know, Dr. Oaken had like a much bigger part in this film than I think he did in the original. And his shit was just hilarious.
Yes.
I got to say, the only downside of this movie for me is there really wasn't that epic speech that Bill Pullman did in the first movie. I mean, there was a couple of attempts. Like, Bill Pullman has, like, another kind of rallying speech, like, after the first time we get our ass kicked by the aliens. It's pretty good, but he just didn't have the passion I think he had in the original because he's, like, kind of an older, frailer man at this point. And, you know, and if the new president, when we go for the final battle, I mean, he tried to do an epic speech, but it just kind of fell flat. It was almost like, you know, whatever happens, happens, you know, but we face it together. It's not, there wasn't this like, we're going to kick some ass.
Yes.
It's like, we're going to try to kick some ass and live or die. We're doing it together, folks. So let's rock on. I just don't think there was that epic speech from the first movie.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think that was kind of my I mean, that was such an epic speech that...
Which they do, like, reference it in this movie. Yes. I mean, the president, when she's doing her celebration speech, quotes some of it. And even at the start, when you see, like, basically the aliens getting a distress signal from one of the downed ships, you know, that kind of, you know, lures them back into attacks again, they're getting audio from that original speech in this, like, message, like, hey, these guys kicked our ass, you know. So it's kind of cool, the movie starting with that speech from the previous movie.
Yeah, absolutely. So switching gears a little bit to talk more about the cigar. You know, this thing has maintained its medium. you know, definitely the woody, earthy notes. I did start picking up some hints of leather down toward around the second and final third of the cigar. You know, so that was a nice, you know, this would be a great, enjoyable, you know, cigar, you know, maybe mid-afternoon, after lunch or something like that. Maybe you don't want something full strength. Or if you're outside, you know, if I'm doing, you know, some yard work, the temperature's hot or whatever, this is a great cigar that isn't absolutely trying to kick my ass or anything. So it's been enjoyable all the way through. You know, one of the highlights of this cigar is just the construction of it and everything. So, you know, for me, you know, if I'm looking for a powerhouse, this isn't it. But if I'm looking for, you know, something to hold me over, you know, I could smoke a couple of these cigars a day and, you know, be just fine and feel, you know, happy. And I mean, it's been a great way to pass the segment.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely lighter than what I normally smoke, but it's definitely heavier than because I can't smoke a mild cigar, because to me it's like smoking air. So this is my version of a mild cigar. I mean, it's got enough strength to it that it's going to hold my attention. And with, like I said, the tube and stuff, where it's a good travel cigar, this would be something good if you're going out, you know, hiking, you know, doing your Pokemon a nice round of golf or something like that. Something that's not going to overweigh you.
Something that's happening really soon is we got Dragon Con coming in like 50 something days. Like it's here. This would be a great smoke, you know, if you want to find a balcony or an outside area and, you know, just take an hour of your time and smoke. This is that perfect cigar for that.
Yeah, it's not one that's going to, like, you're going to have to rest afterward. I could smoke this and get right back into the shenanigans.
Yes, absolutely. So that's my final thoughts.
And with that, we'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
Good morning. In less than an hour, aircraft from here will join others from around the world. And you will be launching the largest aerial battle in the history of mankind. Mankind, that word should have new meaning for all of us today. We can't be consumed by our petty differences anymore. We will be united in our common interests. Perhaps it's fate that today is the 4th of July, and you will once again be fighting for our freedom. Not from tyranny, oppression, or persecution, but from annihilation. We're fighting for our right to live, to exist. And should we win the day, the 4th of July will no longer be known as an American holiday, but as the day when the world declared in one voice, we will not go quietly into the night. We will not vanish without a fight. We're going to live on. We're going to survive. Today, we celebrate our Independence Day.
Hey man, it's almost that time.
What time is it?
Beer 30.
Cigar Nerds Podcast.
And we're back. It's time for Beer 30. What are we drinking on this week, Brad?
Well, in lieu of Independence Day just recently wrapping up, you know, I kind of felt compelled and, you know, was wondering, you know, hey, what's a good brewery out there that I know is, you know, supporting veterans and everything. So, yeah, I was perusing the local liquor store and happened to run across another Service Brewing beer that I hadn't had the opportunity to try yet. So yeah,
the last one we tried was the Tufelunden, which I believe was the stout.
Yes.
This week we have the Gun Bunny Wit.
Yep, and you know, this is a summer seasonal, but you know, this is a Belgian styled wit beer infused with Indian coriander seed, sweet tangelo pill, and muddled mandarin orange.
And if you don't know what a gun bunny technically is, according to the bottle, as the action on the battlefield mounts, it's the brave gun bunny who leaps forward swiftly to load the next artillery round. In honor of these courageous men and women, we dedicate this classic Belgian-style wit infused with Indian coriander seed, sweet tangelo peel, and muddled mandarin orange with bright, crisp flavors and a dry finish.
Yeah, so, you know, this is my the first time actually drinking a wit beer on the podcast. And, you know, traditionally I am not too fond of wit beers, but, you know, this one's actually pretty good. The coriander seed really comes through on the front of the palate, but I do get that tangelo and mandarin orange flavor on the back end, but it definitely has that dry finish to it. And, you know, this is a, you know, if I'm sitting outside on a patio and it's 90 degrees, this is a nice beer that is refreshing, it's crisp, but it isn't going to weigh so heavily on the stomach that I'm going to, you know, not be able to enjoy it. So,
yeah, it's definitely a nice light summer beer. Yeah, it's only 5.1% alcohol too. So, and if you're out in hot sun sweating, you could pound a couple of these before you, you know, get pass out drunk.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's from me. I love stouts, but in the summer, drinking a big heavy stout in 100 degree weather is just not fun.
No, I mean, you know, there's a when it comes to beer, you know. People that aren't, you know, necessarily big into the craft scene and everything, you know, that's one reason I think so many people turn to the Coors, the Coronas, the Buds is, you know, they're easy drinking beers. You know, people hate on them because, you know, they're big companies or, you know, it's piss water, whatever the case is. But at the end of the day, you know, if you're outside and I'm doing yard work, whatever the case is, that's the type of beer that I can pound four or five in and not have the effect that if I drink that 14-15% Imperial Stout and, you know, two beers in, I'm no good.
Yeah, and you, like I said, you just because, you know, the macro brews are easy drinkers, you don't have to go to that big brand to find an easy drinking summer beer. I mean, you can get stuff like this, or, you know, there are craft wits, you know, ales, you know, stuff like that are on the lighter side that you can drink like you're drinking a Budweiser, but actually drink something that tastes good.
Yeah, and, you know, once again, the biggest thing about Service Brewing is, one, they're, you know, local here to the state of Georgia, out of Savannah. They're veteran-owned and, you know, veteran-brewed. So, you know, really got to support, you know, the service men and women and everything, you know, that are out there, you know, paying ultimately the ultimate sacrifice.
And making some damn good beer.
Absolutely. I mean,
which is funny. I speaking of Budweiser, I did see a picture that, and I can't remember where it was at, but it was some brewery or bar where their urinals were made out of old beer kegs, and they were using like a Budweiser beer keg for their urinals.
I did see that.
And somebody posted like, I figured out how Budweiser fills their kegs.
I mean, you know, I will say that, you know, as home brewers, that style of beer, the lager, ultimately, is the most difficult style. So what they do well, you know. I mean
it's a mass market beer, but, I mean, and you can make, I mean, Yuengling's a good mass market lager. But when you're brewing lagers, they're fermented cold. So it's not something that as a home brewer that's very easy to make unless you have, like, a fridge or something dedicated to just lagering beer. Or if you're in somewhere where it's, you know, the northern states where it is cold, you know, at least most of the year. With Georgia, we don't get enough, you know, below 50 days in a row to really lager a beer at room temperature.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's the thing is, you know, even when you're talking about room temperature, I mean, you're lagering at 45 degrees. I don't know anybody that is keeping any portion of their house at 45 degrees.
That's what I mean. If you're in a place where there's, you know, actual cold weather, like, you could stick it in your garage if you're, say, in Michigan or somewhere up north where it gets cold for many days in a row. But down here, even in the winter, we don't get, you know, a solid cold day where we could take 3-4 weeks to lager a beer.
Yeah. But I got to say, man, like, this beer pours like sunshine. Like, you know, it's got that hazy goldenness to it. Like,
stepping on sunshine.
Yeah. Like, I look at this beer and I, you know, instantly, you know, my head goes to I'm on a beach or, you know, somewhere like that. And, I mean, it just screams warmth.
Yeah, it is very golden.
So, you know, I you know, once again, I mean, for a wit beer, even though it is not necessarily my first go-to choice, this is everything that you would anticipate out of that, you know, traditional style. And with that, you know, coriander seed coming through, you get that spice and everything. And, I mean, I got to say, man, this is damn good.
Yeah, I mean, the only other wit beer that I really have any experience drinking is probably Hoegaarden. And even then, you don't have as much of the fruity flavors as you're getting with this beer. And most of the time, if I'm drinking a Hoegaarden, I'm drinking a Dirty Ho, which is basically a black and tan with a Hoegaarden and Guinness.
Yes. love me some Dirty Ho.
So, what are you going to rate this on the Untappd app?
I mean, I'm at a 4 here.
Yeah, I'm definitely at a solid 4.
I mean, like I said, and you know, if you're asking me about my personal, you know, opinion, it's a 4. If you're asking me, you know, going down a brew sheet on what is a wit, you know, the coloring, the IBUs, the mouthfeel, the crispness, I mean, it's a solid 5 in, you know, the sense of what a wit beer should be.
And I'm all the way out.
Yeah.
And with that, we'll be right back.
Stay tuned.
Yes, science! And we're back, and it's time for science!
Yeah.
If you hear any explosions in the background, the neighbors are still setting off 4th of July fireworks a week later.
And I'm not complaining. In fact, I'm upset. I want to go watch.
Yeah, we need more explosives in our life.
Dude. All right. I'm about to go on a tangent about the adult, like, snap crackers that, you know.
Those things are freaking awesome. speaking of snapping things, NASA has invented robo-gloves that could double the strength of your hand.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know, we watched Hardcore Henry the other night, and the guy crushes some pervert's nuts with his robo hand. So, yeah, that could get dangerous if you had a more powerful grip.
I'm going to leave that alone.
this thing has been in development for 9 years. It's a joint project with General Motors and NASA. It was originally developed for the Robonaut 2, which is a robot that's been up at the International Space Station since, I think it was launched in 2012. And basically, they've taken the technology they used in, you know, developing the hands of this robot to make a glove that would actually increase the pressure of your strength of your hand without losing any kind of dexterity. It's more like a soft exoskeleton for your hand. And like I said, it can basically, for example, if you had to exert 20 pounds of pressure to properly operate a tool with this glove, you may only have to exert 5 to 10 pounds of pressure.
So, I mean, that would be awesome. Like, kind of one of the things that comes to my mind is if you're on an assembly line or something like that, doing repetitive motions and everything. I mean, this, you know, might be a great way to help, you know, combat, you know, carpal tunnel and some of the other, you know.
Yeah, that was one of the kind of the implementation, because I know anybody who's ever tried to put together a IKEA desk when it's all screws and you don't have an electric screwdriver, your hand gets tired after a while. But
electric screwdriver, hell, all of that stops Allen keys. Even worse.
But with these
robot
gloves, where it, you know, reduces the amount of pressure needed to control an item, you know, can make, you know, allow you to work longer. Or, like I said, if, you know, future versions of this where maybe they even increase the pressure greater, that you might even not need tools. I mean, if you could reach in something and
grab a nut or something.
Yeah, and like, and then, you know, unbolt something without needing your ratchets. Because I know sometimes, especially working on an engine, you know, there's not a whole lot of room to get your hands in there. You know, all these things were put together outside of the car and then put into the car. So trying to remove a part of an engine when you're having to go around hoses and fenders and whatnot, Yeah. Sometimes it's hard to get a wrench in there and get a full range of movement. But if you've got some kind of robot glove that increases your, you know, finger strength, and you can just reach in there and unscrew a nut barehanded, or, well, robot-handed, definitely make things a lot easier in the mechanical implemented. And they're also, even, like I said, they're, you know, looking at this to go into the medical community to, like, assist surgeons and stuff who has to do long, delicate work with their hands. You know, the robot hands may make that, you know, easier. They're not going to get the fatigue if they're in a, you know, multi-hour-long surgery.
Yeah. No, I mean, that could definitely be a huge benefit.
In other robot news, they've also developed a cyborg stingray.
Interesting.
Made with rat hearts.
All right, cool. Known as a soft robot.
Yeah, basically it has a gold skeleton covered in a highly flexible polymer, much like the skin of a actual stingray. But these things are only about the size of a coin. And also in there, they're using genetically engineered, like 200,000 genetically engineered light-sensitive rat heart cells called photovoltaic cardiomyoses. It's a big freaking word. And basically, like I said, this, you know, it's kind of a, I don't know, an early proof of concept design, you know, but this thing is basically with this, it moves like a stingray, you know, it can actually swim, but it's not fully autonomous yet. Basically, they control it with a light source. You know, basically when these cells get hit by light, they contract. And then, you know, circuitry in the gold skeleton holds some of that electricity and can, you know, actually power it to, you know, release and, you know, cause your flapping motion. And depending on the intensity of the light and the type of light shine can actually, you know, make it move faster, slower, and actually steer this thing. In the early tests, they navigated a full maze with basically guiding this thing with some kind of light source. And it, you know, performed it. I mean, cause this is like almost like the early stages of nanobot technology. I mean, we've got shit down to a coin now. You know, the next level is going to be something much, much smaller, or even something much, much bigger. Because the implication of using this particular cells is like in a traditional robot, you've got to have a robot brain and, you know, controllers that will activate robotic muscles and whatnot. But with this, since they are light sensitive, it eliminates the whole need of that other controlling circuitry, solenoids, whatnot, because it's all done naturally by the muscles.
So basically, the brighter the light source, the greater the energy, the faster, you know, the motion.
Pretty much, like I said, without needing any kind of other guidance. Like I said, it doesn't have to have a computer controlling a solenoid, you're telling it to open and close, so it eliminates a lot of that extra computing power.
Yep.
By doing this kind of like biomechanical, you know, speaking of like the aliens from ID4, biomechanical creation.
Interesting. I'm just wondering, you know, I mean, this is all cool stuff here. I'm just, you know, like, why? Like, because we can? Or like, we're going to have like genetically modified cyborgs swimming out in the ocean or something? Like,
well,
you know.
Well, like I said, it's not really got any kind of, I don't know, I guess particularly use right now, but the technology that goes into making that thing can fuel other technology.
Yeah.
This is kind of almost like a proof of concept robot where it's, you know, if we can develop something that operates like this marine animal,
it's almost
we can,
like we've used rat hearts instead of solar panels.
Yeah. So, yeah. And, you know, and these are grown in a dish, rat hearts. They're not cutting out rats to get these cells. So, yeah. Calm down, PETA.
My rats are safe. Yay.
But yeah, basically, like I said, if, yeah, they've already made a robotic jellyfish, but like I said, the movements and the control of this thing is much more complicated, which can develop, you know, lead to developing even more complicated imitations of life. And like I said, as we kind of develop this technology, then we can use it in other areas. But this is basically a science for science purposes. They don't have like a set going like, we're building this because we want to do this. It's like, we're building this to prove that we can do this, and then we'll figure out what else we can do with this stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
And on that note, which some new technology that may be the downfall of society, if my Facebook feed from this weekend is any indication, the new Pokemon Go app has come out, and it's already having many, many unintended negative effects. For example, there's been people who have walked out into traffic and gotten hit while chasing Pokemon, or have been playing Pokemon in their car and crashed their car. Or even one story that was floating around the internet where a girl who was checking out a river looking for water Pokemon found a dead body. But the latest, and I guess criminal innovation would be a good way to title it, armed robbers are using Pokemon Go to find victims.
Yep, and that's why I stay strapped.
Yeah, basically, if you haven't played this game, it forces you to go out into the real world to find Pokemon and stuff. And there's places called Pokestops or gyms where you can go get stuff for the game or battle people at these gyms. Well, in O'Fallon, Missouri, four guys have been staking out popular Pokemon stop locations and robbing the people when they come there to play Pokemon.
I guess they weren't staking out the local police station.
No, it didn't say where they were actually at, but yeah, they're just a popular Pokemon spot, and yeah, they've basically robbed like, you know, 9 people in the last couple of days. They were eventually caught, and it was 4 guys from like 16 to 18. But like one of their robberies was at 2 a.m. I mean, dude, like just wait till the morning to get your Pokeballs. Like if you're looking for Pokemon at 2 in the morning, get a life. And as I say that, I'll probably go out and look for Pokemon after this recording is over. But
well, I mean,
you know, I walk around with your face in your phone the whole time. Be aware of your surroundings.
I mean, I think that's the standard to anything. I mean, before Pokemon Go, you had people, you know, walking and texting that were, you know, either bumping into other people or, you know, once again, just, you know, kind of unaware of their surroundings. But, you know.
But with this, you add to it the fact that people are going to be going to a
designated spot. Like yep.
So, you know, for these criminals, you know, it's like, hey, if we wait here, there's going to be people showing up with their face in their phone, not paying much attention, that probably has, you know, at least we know a smartphone, if not other money. And just, we don't have to go out and hunt people to rob. We can just wait for them to show up.
I mean
it's kind of impressive.
I mean, to the criminals out there, mind you, some of us stay strapped.
Yeah.
Come at me, brah.
Yeah. Nerds come in all forms.
Some of us are quite the marksman.
Oh,
I mean, that might be a great way to weed out the criminals. You know, I mean, you know, I have seen, you know, on the reverse side, you know, police stepping up patrols in areas that are Pokestops and stuff like that. So, you know, it might be a great, you know, way that, you know, the lowest common denominator being the criminal ends up getting their own ass handed to them.
Yeah, because I saw a posting I guess a local fire department was designated a pokey spot, and they had a sign that was like, you know, we really hope you catch them all and have a good time, but if you hear the sirens go off, please vacate the driveway so we don't run you over when we leave for a call.
Yes.
Oh.
That or the one that was the police station, and they're like, yes, you don't actually need to come inside the facility.
Yeah. And so, yeah, there was like, I think it was in Australia where they had like, the local police department had to tweet out a notice that was like, yeah, you know, we're glad you're having a good time, but the police station is designated a poke spot, but you don't physically have to come into the building to log in, and please look up from your phone when crossing the street.
But, I mean, I will say that, you know, some of the benefits, I mean, you're getting a lot of people, you know, the big apps, you know, whether it was the S-Health or whether you're tracking your steps through your Fitbit or whatever. I mean, this is a great way to get exercise, enjoy, you know. So, I mean, I definitely think the positive ramifications of this.
Yeah, I did see a joke news article that was like, sore legs have become a pandemic as Pokemon Go tricks people into actually exercising.
But, I mean, it's a great way to have fun, get off the couch, do something, and it, you know, in a way, interact with other people. I can't tell you how many stories I've heard of people, you know, walking around parks, and it's people of all generations. It's not just kids or, you know, teenagers or adults.
One of my friends had posted that he had pulled into a spot that was like a Pokemon gym and happened to meet some girl because some girl pulled in to do the same thing.
Yeah, I mean.
it's weird. It was funny because we were at the cigar shop the other day, and like there's these probably college age kids coming there to get some cigars, and they go to check out, and they're like, you know, he's like, "Hold on, dude, I got to catch this Caterpie before he pays for his cigar." Oh man, yeah, it's funny. It's like we'll talk about it more in nerd news, but yeah, it's becoming a phenomenon.
As much negativity that's out there, I think the positive ramifications are going to far outweigh the negative.
Yeah. I gotta force my fat ass to get out and walk,
and actually look forward to doing it. Like, I mean, we could get out and walk, and you know, be like, "Fuck, we're exercising," and demotivate ourselves, and get back on the couch, and in, you know, 30 minutes or an hour. But you know, I mean, I found myself. I walked a couple of miles the other night without even realizing I had gone that distance.
I tried to cheat and just ride around the car, but you got to be going like too. It knows you're. You're cheating if you go too fast. So it's like, damn it. It wants me to actually walk. But also in other robot news, M&M shooting drones are being used to save the black-footed ferret.
Awesome.
Yeah, the problem with the black-footed ferret is very endangered at this point. And like I said, it's been announced as extinct twice. So like I said, we're basically, I think there's like maybe 300 remaining wild ferrets. And the problem is these things feed on prairie dogs. And currently a lot of the prairie dog population is getting killed off by a flea-borne sylvatic plague that's wiping out a lot of the ferrets, you know, food source. So as the prairie dogs die off, it's immediately killing the ferrets. So one of the things they're trying to do is, you know, they've come up with a inoculation for this plague, but it's hard to administer that to a whole bunch of different prairie dogs, because basically they have to maybe drop these like peanut butter wrapped cure pills, you know, one every 30 feet or so, because they can't just drop it in one location because you'll get one really fat prairie dog. So they have to spread this out over like maybe a 1,200 acre environment. And so there's doing this by hand is very time consuming. And also, you know, prairie dogs are going to run from you. They're not, you know, it's hard to, you know, administer dosage to these animals on a wide space. So one of the solutions that they're currently testing is these drones that will, you know, automatically fly around and drop pills in a preferred location, and like I said, it can do it, you know, 50 times faster than a human doing it by hand. So that's one of the things that they're currently trying to, it's kind of in the testing approval phase, but you know, they're hoping to at least have a workable prototype by August.
That's awesome.
So yeah, now you know robots doing something good for humanity, but then again, this could be the start of the hunter killer drones. We're teaching them to track down prairie dogs. The next thing will happen, they'll start tracking down us.
Administering peanut butter flavored vaccines.
Yeah, but maybe they'll be poisoned by then. Because, like, yeah,
can we not just end on a positive note?
I mean, you know, like James Woods in Family Guy, where they're like trailing him with the M&Ms. It's like, ooh, piece of candy. Ooh, piece of candy. Ooh, piece. Oh, I fell in a trap. Damn it. And with that note, we'll be right back with some nerd news.
Stay tuned.
Hey guys!
Hi!
Check out Rec Level 3.
What's that?
We're a gaming, geek, nerd culture fandom podcast.
Ooh. Wow!
And you can find us every Friday at 11:30 a.m. on reclevel3.com.
Yay!
And now it's time for all things nerdy in nerd news.
And welcome to Nerd News. So, we're going to talk about some video game stuff, and, yep, it's not going to be Pokemon Go. So Evil Dead 2, the board game, has successfully been funded on Kickstarter in under a day.
I thought you said video games.
Our games in general.
Okay.
So, you know, basically the game, they were looking to try to get $70,000 to become reality. And as of right now, with 32 days left in the campaign, it's got like
$153,000.
Yeah. So, you know, I was looking over some of the video on the mechanics of the games and the miniatures and everything else. And, you know, there's a lot of games, you know, unfortunately, that rely on movie plots or whatever. And their game counterparts suck.
What do I have to roll to use a boomstick?
Well, you know, in this, you're actually going to get, you know, event cards, you know, the Ex Mortis cards, Deadeye enemy tokens. You even get to fight the Severed Hand enemies. So there's also possessed animals, demons, and the infamous tree.
Dead by Dawn, Dead by Dawn.
So, you know,
you know those memes of like where someone's like trying to do something and they try to roll and it shows them rolling a one and bad shit happens. It's like, yep. Oh, you rolled for initiative. Oh, you rolled a one. You're getting tree raped.
But I mean, you know, it looks like it's going to be a combination of a dice roll, you know, where it looks like you're actually playing the game itself. So I think this game's for anywhere from 2 to 6 players. You know, watching the video, it looks enjoyable and fun. Like, I'm going to go ahead and get on there just so I can get the early edition of the game. And that way we can actually get some real time rolling the dice and everything, see how it plays. Because there's not too many games that come out that you can get by just playing two players from a board game perspective.
That is an issue on most games.
Yeah, absolutely. So up next with some game news. So we had the release of Pokemon Go. And, you know, we both have fired up our smartphones, downloaded the app, and, you know, the first day or two was quite, you know, not necessarily buggish, but I guess Nintendo, they just didn't expect the traffic that Pokemon was going to generate. So, you know, there's been a lot of server issues and stuff like that, but, you know, looking at the version number, this is like version 0.29, and I know most of the time when a final release of something is put into production from a developer standpoint, it comes out at version 1. So I'm wondering if this is maybe more of a, you know, unofficial open beta that we're, you know, going through right now. And
yeah, because I know it's not available on iPhones yet. It's only out for Androids, and there's certain countries or states that it's not operating in yet. So, yeah, I mean, we pretty much could be in, like I said, just a, you know, kind of a test rollout phase.
But, you know, it's cool, you know, because it, you know, incorporates the real world. So it uses the, you know, global positioning on your cell phone device and, you know, basically allows you to go around to different areas and, you know, participate in gyms or, you know, visit Pokestops where you can up your Pokeballs and stuff like that. In addition to also, you know, it kind of forces you to get off your ass and exercise if you want to, you know, be a successful Pokemon catcher. You know, so if you're going for the pro trainer level, you're really going to have to work at it. Like, you're not just going to get on the couch and, you know, stumble across all there is to find.
I mean, you could tie it to your dog to get your mileage in there and let it run around the yard for an hour.
If it's anything like my dogs, they would be like, oh, there's a foreign object. I'm just going to sit or I'm going to lay down or I'm going to destroy whatever it is touching me.
Yeah, I've not been able to find a sufficiently lazy way to play it yet.
But, I mean, it's been cool, you know, as we talked about in science, you know. I mean, people, all ages, all walks of life coming together in common areas. And, you know, once again, there's so much negativity going around right now in the media and everything that this is definitely a positive light. Yeah, I'm sure there's been a couple of bad scenarios and situations arise, but I think the positive implications here far outweigh the negative.
Yeah, I think that's just weeding out the stupid. It's like it's like thinning out the gene pool there. You know, if you walk out into traffic, you know, it's kind of makes everyone else smarter.
Maybe. I mean, I don't know. You're kind of going back to, you know, people used to tell me, stay alert, stay alive. I mean, be aware of your surroundings, I guess. I mean,
yeah, I'm like, you know, when they started making everything safe, we, you know, like the overall intelligence of the populace, I think, like went down because too many dumb people like started surviving because we made stuff too safe. I mean, back in the day, you'd weed out them, you know, and
we would give most of those folks a Darwin Award and move on.
Yeah, yeah, but now there's like too many stupid people around.
Yeah, I mean, that's cynical. Why do you always want to take it to the dark side? Like, I'm trying to give a positive, uplifting, good nerdy vibes. And
I mean, it is fun.
It is fun. We have been made fun of, and then the same people making fun of us are like, I got to go try that.
Oh, yeah, like the first day, it was, like, blowing up on my Facebook feed, and, like, you kind of, like, downloaded, just like, hey, I'm going to figure out what this is out. The next thing you know, you're, like, walking around the house looking for Pokemon and shit, and I'm like, oh, this is fucking stupid. Like, the next day, I, like, downloaded it. I'm like, all right, I'm hooked, too. God damn it. Like, I downloaded this just so I can make fun of you. And then I'm like, oh, fuck, it's actually, like, entertaining. Son of a bitch. I'm caught.
And, you know, apparently we're not the only ones to find it entertaining. You know, Nintendo shares have actually soared, you know, over 10%. You know,
all the way up.
Yeah, as, you know, the Pokemon game has been released and everything. So, you know, there's definitely been some big implications. I don't know, man. Like, one of the things I wanted to talk about was Blink-182 just had an album drop this year, or this month, rather. When's the last time you heard anything from those guys?
It's been a while.
You know, we've got Pokemon resurging and everything. Independence Day is, you know, released again. Like, are we about to have the 90 boom all over?
Oh, yeah, like, I mean, and it's kind of like one of those things that, you know, Nintendo's not been doing that well in the market. Like I said, I used to love Nintendo, but I've not owned a Nintendo system since the 64 because they've kind of turned more into a family-friendly kid game stuff in, like, you know, invested heavily in the motion sensor controllers and all that stuff that just have not competed that well with PlayStation and Xbox. So them moving into the mobile market may be a way for them to stick around, and you know, because I don't want to spend $150 or $200 on a new Nintendo console. But if I could play old school Super Mario on my phone, or you know, a Zelda, you know, game, something like that, I would be more willing to throw a couple bucks their way than, you know, buying a whole system that doesn't have enough games to keep me entertained.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, like you said, they've definitely been geared more toward the family-friendly. And, you know, unfortunately, like, the console systems that have come out, you know.
As a single gamer, it's like, yeah, I don't have any kids to share my Nintendo with. So,
well,
I'm like, if I'm going to buy an Xbox One or a PS4 a PC for my gaming needs.
But, you know, your gaming needs, you know, that's one of the big things I think that's kind of set Nintendo back a little bit is, you know, the PC markets, the, you know, PS4 and Xbox One. I mean, those are high-end, you know, driven games. What are you doing? You're playing the latest big titles, you know, your Call of Duties. You're not going to play on the Wii Call of Duty and, you know, the Halos and...
I do gotta say that new Zelda looks amazing, though. That's the only thing that might be worth getting a Nintendo for.
I don't know. I mean, I've been really, you know, curious to, you know, possibly pick up a Wii U. I've got the original Wii now, but... To your point, I'm playing a lot of older Nintendo games and stuff like that on it, more so than I am, you know, rushing out to try to buy. If there's a new game coming out, I'm getting it on the Xbox One or I'm getting it on PC.
Like, yeah, I mean, I was out and about today, and I was wearing my player hat that has like an old school NES controller on it. And some dude at the gas station was like, oh, shit, man, you a player? And started asking me about, like, you know, if I still had my old systems and stuff. So I'm like, yeah, as far as Nintendo goes, I think it's those OG systems that still has everyone's, you know, imagination. Like I said, I'd much rather play old Nintendo versus new Nintendo.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. The old Nintendo, like, That's truly a challenge. Yeah. You don't have save points.
No.
You have spotty hardware at best. I mean, I can't tell you how many times like I'd be into a game and I'd be like, man, I need to crash. So I'd leave the game system on just to turn the TV on. And during the course of me napping or whatever, you know, something glitching that's unrecoverable. And there's no save point. It's start all over again.
Yeah, you got to blow it, tap it, shake it back and forth and to get to work.
So up next in some video game news, a game that was near and dear that I absolutely love to play. Red Dead Redemption has made a resurgence on the Xbox One.
Grand Theft Auto with horses.
Yes. some of the highlights here is this game has not been remastered. However, they did make some improvements. So, you know, in some of the towns where you had a lot going on, you know, multiple characters getting involved in firefights with animals and stuff scurrying in the background, on the 360, your frame rates and stuff would drop somewhere, you know, 18 to 20 frames per second. Xbox One, pretty much consistently right at 30 frames. So, you know, you're going to have a much smoother gameplay experience and everything, even though the game hasn't been remastered. So, you know, that to me is a big highlight. And plus, there was a lot of playability with Red Dead Redemption. I mean, much like, to your point with the Grand Theft Auto games. I mean, the worlds just keep getting bigger and bigger.
Yeah, if you're not playing the storyline, you can just roam around and hunt stuff and cause random chaos.
I mean, it was one of the closest things to Oregon Trail I could think of. Like, oh yeah, I'm going to, you know, kill this animal and then I'm going to, you know, skin it and get the pelt or whatever and I can, you know, trade or sell it or, you know, use it for...
There was like the hunting, like, achievements and there was the finding
a lot
of
the
in-game
achievements
Yeah.
You know, whether it's, you know, some of the old poker games or...
Yeah, they had all the casino. And you could also get drunk, too, when you go in the bars. It was funny. Yes. Keep doing shots, and then he'd, like, be stumbling around for a couple minutes, and, like, the controls were all reversed, and he'd, like, fall over. It was hilarious. And then they had that the zombie expansion.
Yeah, the undead expansion. And then there's been several others that they've, you know, added to.
I've been meaning to replay that because it's like it also had that element kind of like the old, Knights of the Old Republic, where you could either be a good guy or you could be an outlaw. And like when I played it all through, I was like the hero guy. So I've been kind of wanting to go back and play it again and make all the wrong decisions and just be like the outlaw.
Oh, Josie Wells. But, you know, if you own the game on 360, pop in your disc. It's a free digital download on the Xbox One. If you don't own the game, I think it's like $7 or something for the game on Xbox One right now through the Xbox Live stores. So, I mean, at $7, you're definitely getting your money's worth.
Yep.
All right, so switching gears a little bit, Kevin Smith is set to direct another Flash episode for season 3. So he will be directing, looks like the first week of September, episode 7.
I suppose he might be doing some like Arrow stuff too.
Yeah, he keeps coming out and, you know, saying, hey, I want to do Arrow, but... You know, as of yet, nothing official has come from, you know, the producers of Arrow or anything to reach out and make that a thing. But, I mean, the last Flash episode that Kevin Smith did was freaking awesome.
Yeah.
Like,
and also, I mean, that whole DC universe over there is constantly expanding. I mean, this upcoming season, we're going to get Supergirl. We're also going to get, I saw a couple days ago that they've bought, that Constantine may be coming back. I think they've worked out a deal where they've, you know, because they had an episode with Constantine last season on Arrow, but they're trying to reboot that as an ongoing series again since, you know, it kind of failed on NBC.
Yep, absolutely. So, you know, I don't know. It'll be something to check out. I would like to see him do some stuff with Arrow. You know, the other thing, too, is if you miss Kevin Smith, he will be returning to Comic Book Man in this October.
Another thing I saw that popped up today that apparently John Barrowman, who is, like, one of my favorite people, he's always hilarious at Dragon Con, who has played Michael Merlin in Arrow. Apparently, he has signed on as a series regular across all CWDC shows. So he could pop up anywhere at this point.
Yeah, I was wondering when that was going to be a thing. You know, I don't know. I love, you know, him as a person. You know, like you said, at Dragon Con, his appearances and everything, he is absolutely hilarious, you know. I don't think that Arrow, you know, has really done, you know, too much justice. Like, it's hard for me to take his character seriously.
Yeah,
his character
is like almost kind of ran its course, but if they're going to put him in The Flash, Legends of Tomorrow, all these other series, maybe they can come up with something new and interesting for him to do, because it's kind of just, yeah. I'm kind of like, I think he had a good run, but it's kind of, you know, either kill him or wrap it up.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing is, you know, I don't know, you know, we'll just have to kind of stay tuned. But, you know, I don't feel like that his character, you know, right now, I mean, it's, I don't know whether to take you seriously, or are you joking, or what the hell is
the bad guy
on
again, off again, like, oh, this week I'm a hero, next week I'm going to betray you. Yeah, it's kind of getting old. Like, so if they're going to keep him and make him part of all the series, they're going to have to give him something interesting to do.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, up next in TV news, we'll talk about a little something with Game of Thrones and the upcoming Season 7. Ultimately, Season 7 has been delayed. Care to take a guess why?
Because winter's not coming?
Winter has not come, apparently. We're having too much sunny weather. you know, so basically the producers have, you know, really looking for, you know, grim weather patterns and everything else, and you know, with winter here, sunny weather, you know, beach towels and, you know, swim shorts and bikinis are not what, you know, is going to make this
people start having heat stroke and all that armor and stuff.
Yeah,
but if you want to see winter coming, you know, watch the Game of Thrones, a porn parody Game of Bones.
Jeez. Give me a warning next time.
No one expects the Spanish Inquisition.
The Spanish are coming. The Spanish are coming. Back to an old Monty Python throwback. Such good classics. And then up next, a little bit of comic book news. So we touched on a little bit earlier with the resurgence of the 90s. Apparently, you know, we're in some kind of time capsule. So
bring Highlander back.
Boom Studios.
Bring my 90s waistline back.
Is, you know, going to be publishing the WWE comic books and graphic novels.
Mm.
Yeah, so I don't know. I'm kind of curious to check it out. I missed, you know, some of the earlier 90 runs that, you know, at the time, I guess it was WWF, you know, had put out and stuff. So I'm curious to see what happens, you know, with this latest round. So something to stay tuned for. So
maybe we can see The Rock show up in Avengers.
But you know, it's kind of cool, you know, because you know, Boom has done, you know, everything from Mighty Morphin Power Rangers to Big Trouble in Little China, as well as Adventure Time. So you know, I mean, they've got some good stuff under their belt, so I'm curious to see, you know, what kind of shenanigans and, you know, everything they have to offer with you know, the comics and graphic novels alike. So that will wrap us up for this segment of Nerd News. Any other thoughts, feedback?
No, with that,
we're going to go catch Pokemon. On,
check us out on CigarNerdPodcast.com and on the ESO Network at ESOPodcast.com. Check us out on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Cigar Nerd Pod. Also, go check out some shirts on our Zazzle store and at Real Men Smoke Cigars. And with that, welcome to Earth, bitch! And this has been a recording of the Cigar Nerd Podcast with your hosts, Smokin' Joe and Brad Jackson. Join us next time for more adventures in nerddom.
This has been a broadcast of the ESO Network, your station for all things geek, classic, current, and beyond. Be part of the crew at ESONetwork.com.